Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Print Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lara, but today joined by Marius Ruit. Marius, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Nick.
I'm all right, I'm all right. I'm also joined today by Dr. John Andrus. John, how are you doing?
How's it, Nick? All good.
Indeed, indeed. Spring is almost upon us, and things are starting to warm up a bit. I suspect it's the last little touch of cold before spring begins to set in nicely, so that's quite fun. But let's get into the news of today, and that is that everyone continues to be kind of confused about what exactly is going on in the city of Tshwane. Now, there was supposed to be today a motion of no confidence held in the mayor of Tshwane, and it looked very strongly as though Action SA was going to support the ANC and EFF in this vote, which would throw the DA out of government. In Tshwane and break up the multi-party coalition, which whose main members in Tshwane are Action SA and the DA. This was sort of confirmed by Action SA's council caucus leader yesterday, who told the media that Action SA was planning to vote against Mayor Silias Brink in Tshwane. However, things got a little bit more complicated when this morning Action SA Gauteng leader Funzi Nkubeni said that they actually hadn't made a decision yet on whether this thing was going to go ahead, and that there's currently a review process that they're doing before any decision can be made. He said, quote, "Once this review process has been concluded, Action SA will be in a position to communicate our position in the city of Tshwane. We remain committed to our strategic priorities, which includes insourcing, inner city rejuvenation and immigration, as well as improved service delivery for all residents of the city of Tshwane." Silias Brink yesterday said, "We as a coalition have had no notice of this, no formal writing, no clear indication that this was going to be the case, that is, that Action SA would break from the agreement. But we can accept only accept, given what has happened, given the statements made by Herman Mashaba and others, given the fact that our repeated attempts to meet with the leadership of Action SA have been rebuffed, that this is in fact the situation. This is deeply disappointing." So that motion of no confidence was postponed due to a legal challenge by the DA, who says that there are procedural irregularities in the council sitting that's calling us. But John, let me start with you. I mean, what's so strange about this is the way that Action SA has clearly been kind of laying the groundwork for throwing the ANC out, the DA out in Tshwane, right? Saying Shaba said things like the relationship with the DA is abusive. There's been lots of attacks on the DA. They've said that the DA is only helping the white residents of Tshwane, all sorts of stuff like that. And now suddenly, just as it seems to come down to it, Action SA pulls back, reverses course, and is now sort of being ambiguous again. I mean, it's kind of difficult to puzzle what the hell is going on here. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it really is intriguing and a little bit hard to track what's going on here. I think overall the thrust of the direction of movement as much as you describe it. So the plan is to get the DA out of municipal government as much as possible. That's I think Action SA's intention. But of course there are other parties involved as well, and I do wonder what their role is. So the ANC finds itself in an interesting position because we see a bit of a conflict between the Gauteng ANC and the national ANC in terms of where the alliances lie. And that feeds through to the municipal level and the metros, as we're seeing. And I do wonder to what extent the ANC is looking at this Action SA switch and wondering if this is a good partner to go into government with, and whether some of the reluctance and the delays that we're seeing now are maybe even coming from the ANC side. You are saying, look, at national level, this ANC DA tie-up seems to be working quite well. And now we see how in Gauteng things are shifting a little bit. Action SA is playing a kingmaker role. It's making the deals happen. But we don't know if we should be working with them because they were very much opposed to working with us throughout the entire election and run up to the election. Now they're doing things with us, but is this the kind of partner we want to work with in order to be in government? So I think that it's not just the Action SA decision-making processes that are delaying the process as a whole. I think it's not just the legal processes, but I think it may well also be that the ANC is wanting to, have another think about where it wants to go. And so everybody's just slowing things down a little bit in Tshwane while they think about this. Nick.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear what Action SA is going to get out of any potential deal with the ANC. So currently, Action SA holds a number of MMC positions in Tshwane alongside the DA and I think the Freedom Front Plus and some of the other smaller parties. But yeah, Maurice, it's sort of because Action SA has said in public that they're not really interested in going into, at least this was with regards to Joburg, they don't want any positions in the executive. They were very aggressively stated at the press conference they had when they announced they were going to be supporting the ANC in Joburg that this wasn't a coalition with the ANC. This was a supply and confidence agreement, that this had nothing to do with them assuming executive power. So I don't know. Do you think they're going to continue that in Tshwane if they do go in with the ANC, that they're going to just hold the speaker role and give up all of their MNC positions? Or do you think that with the ANC here, they're going to cut some sort of deal and say, okay, well, you know, we want one more MMC position than we already had in Tshwane. And maybe that's also if indeed the ANC is being hesitant to get involved in this, maybe that's also contributing to the ANC's reluctance, is that it doesn't want to give up so many positions to Action SA. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. What do you make of this, Morris?
Don't forget, they also have the deputy mayor position, Action SA, in Tshwane. So they've got quite a few positions. They got a bit of power in Tshwane.
A position that was created basically just for them. There wasn't previously a
deputy
mayor in Tshwane.
Yeah, so it was created to keep Action SA happy. So, this is all quite confusing to me. I think Action SA going into coalition in Johannesburg with the ANC is actually fine if it keeps out the EFF and those kinds of parties. As it stands, I think Action SA and the ANC are one short of a majority together in Joburg. They need, you know, one or two other smaller parties to get them up to 50%. And I think that would stabilize governance in Joburg. We know it's been terrible over the last couple of years, and there've been some, the EFF has obviously been in government, and, you know, characters like Kabela Gwamanda from the Al-Jamaa, who's definitely wasn't, I don't think he was cut out to be the mayor of such a big city, you know, holding such an executive position. So I think to stabilize government in Johannesburg, it's perfectly fine for Action SA to go into coalition with the ANC. But what's happening in Tshwane, it seems that Tshwane is starting to turn the corner. Ratings Africa recently said it had improved its financial situation the most out of all the 8 metros, off a very poor base. I mean, financial stability is still up in the air, Tshwane, but they seem to be doing a bit better. The Auditor General also recently released a report, and also said Tshwane had been the biggest improver out of all the 8 metros. So, and obviously, I mean, things like your audit outcomes aren't the only indicator of governance. There are a whole bunch of other things, but I do think if you are stabilizing your finances, it's probably fair to assume that you're starting to get other things right as well. So this is all pretty confusing, but there's just one thing I'd like to also mention. So currently the governing coalition in Tshwane is made up of the DA, Action SA, Freedom Front Plus, ACDP, IFP, and DOP, the Defenders of the People, which give them 109 out of the 214 seats. So you obviously need 108 to have a majority. But I see now, according to media reports, the ACDP is actually considering is back in this motion of no confidence with Action SA and the ANC. So even if the ACDP, they've got 2 seats in Tshwane, if they decided to go over to the ANC side, even without Action SA, then we'd have a dead heat in Tshwane. We'd have 107 for the DA coalition, 107 for the ANC and EFF coalition. So I'd also, nobody's really spoken about the ACDP. And if that media report is correct, I'd like to know what's going on there, because the ACDP, along with the Freedom Front Plus, has probably been the DA's most reliable coalition partners, I think. So I'd like to, it'd be quite interesting to know what's happening with the ACDP, and if they also kind of annoyed that the DA has gone into the GNU after both being members of the multi-party charter, and I wonder if the ACDP is now seeing as a sort of betrayal or something, or if this is just the Tshwane, the two ACDP Tshwane councillors rebelling against what the national ACDP wants. But I mean, this is all just speculation. I'm not too sure.
John, do you have any final thoughts on this sort of somewhat bizarre episode in our local politics.
I think I'm mainly looking forward to seeing more tea leaves be added to our reading of them, because at the moment, the tea leaves are not very clear. So, yeah, I think events in the next, you know, few days, next 2 weeks or so, will show us where things are going. At the moment, it is quite muddy.
Yeah, we just get a goat to look at its entrails, see what happens.
Maybe. I think, though, that if Action Estate does indeed go ahead with something like this, it will be very damaging to the party's electoral prospects. we'll have to see whether they agree or whether other concerns override that. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is from President Ramaphosa, who has said that South Africa is very, very eager to have a sovereign wealth fund. I presume something like the one that Norway has, where the government sort of puts money into this big fund from its oil profits and then gives them out to the citizens. But Ramaphosa has said that while this is a key ANC priority, that basically there's no money to do anything like this. He said, with our current fiscal position with substantial current account and budget deficits, it is currently not the most opportune and favorable time for us to establish a sovereign wealth fund. Funding for service delivery remains under pressure for us. While conditions do not currently exist for the immediate establishment of a sovereign wealth fund, this is an objective for which we should continue to work. We are committed to creating a sovereign wealth fund. It is generally accepted that we should have a sovereign wealth fund, Ramaphosa said. It could be used to support economic and social development. Sovereign wealth funds are, by their nature, often used by many countries to harness national resources for economic as well as social development. They're often used to preserve and grow a country's wealth for the benefit of future generations. He said that the Public Investment Corporation was an example of what the sovereign wealth fund could become if it was established. So, John, what do you make of this? This is kind of a bit bizarre because, on one hand, it's such an unrealistic proposition, you know, considering that South Africa just doesn't have the money to put into anything like this. And also because we've been driving, you know, if we were going to get the money for a sovereign wealth fund from like oil or something, we've been driving away all the investment and development of our oil, potential oil resources here. So that's not going to happen. What do you make of what the president's doing here?
Yeah, so this proposal of a sovereign wealth fund for South Africa makes absolutely no sense to me. And the reason for it is that you would typically fund a sovereign wealth fund through excess revenue, right? Because it means delayed gratification, delayed spending. It means that the South African state this year has got 100 billion rand, to take one example, that it's not going to spend. It's going to put it into the fund as savings. That's basically what it is. But you need the excess revenue if you want to save it. And we are running deficits. We're borrowing money because we don't have enough money to spend.
Right. It's like saying that you're going to open a new savings account when you're massively maxed out on your credit card.
Exactly like that, yes. So from that perspective, it makes no sense. Sovereign wealth funds typically, when they work really well, like the Norway one, work in a way where you have a natural resource which is generating a lot of foreign currency inflows into your economy, which is very harmful to economies. It creates something called Dutch disease. It makes your own currency strengthen too much and you end up importing too much stuff. It destroys local industry. And so a sovereign wealth fund is like a kind of buffer. You're getting all that revenue in, but you're not spending it. You're just putting it to the side and allowing your economy to remain as undistorted as possible. That's what it's actually for. But that's not the situation we've got in South Africa. As you point out, we might have had it or maybe could still have it in future if we had some more sensible policies around the exploitation of especially energy resources. But that's also, you know, an area where we are driving people away at the moment, or investors away. So it doesn't look like those revenues are coming. Another point to make about sovereign wealth funds is that in the majority of cases, probably, or in very many cases, they tend to get looted because they attract great interest from criminals. You know, there'll be billions and billions of dollars sitting there, and somebody's going to grab that money and run with it. So, you know, in Nigeria, Angola, Venezuela, Brazil, you know, all over the place, sovereign wealth funds are really, really tricky to manage responsibly. And just in closing, Nick, the one concern I have about this is that maybe the cunning plan that underlies these calls for a sovereign wealth fund is that what the government wants to do is transfer private savings into a sovereign wealth fund and say, okay, we've got, you know, 5 trillion rand of pension savings in South Africa, which is money that should really be used for the national development. And so we're going to transfer all of those pension savings into a sovereign wealth fund, and then we'll use the interest from that to pay for Eskom and SAA and so on. So that's a bit of a worry that I've got, and I'm maybe temporarily relieved that Ramaphosa is stepping back from the notion of a sovereign wealth fund. At the current time, I would say it makes no sense.
Yeah, that would be catastrophically disastrous, stupid, just counterproductive. You know, just a mass expropriation of assets, basically. Marius, what do you make of this? It does seem like a positive development that Ramaphosa is rhetorically distancing himself from this. Even if he's promising it some vague point down the line, this still definitely seems like a step in the right direction for the president.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, overall, a sovereign wealth fund isn't a bad idea in theory, but I think John makes excellent points about why South Africa can't use it. I was just looking now, the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund is the assets it has equal to over $300,000 for each Norwegian citizen. So it's obviously, but that's obviously well run. You know, you can trust the Scandinavians or people who've run the countries pretty well over the past couple of decades. You know, that money's going to be used where it should be going. There's no, you know, no Norwegian prime minister is drawing all the money and taking, you know, suitcases of US dollars and to Dubai or something like that. So, but yeah, I mean, South Africa might be a bit of a different story. But I think Sovereign Wealth Fund is, along with things like bullet trains and smart cities and all this kind of stuff, it sounds all very nice when you do the speeches, but South Africa doesn't really have the resources to do it. And it's pretty hard work to actually get it going. And it's just one of those things, it's nice to say in a speech, but there's no way of actually doing it. And yeah, I mean, and the PRC isn't something that's sort of like that, but it's more, I mean, PRC isn't really a sovereign wealth fund, I don't think. It's more like just a government investor. I mean, they'd more invest on behalf of government employees' pensions and all that kind of stuff. Just on that note, though, Namibia is apparently planning on, they're going to have their sovereign wealth fund set up next year. Apparently, they're setting all the, getting all the legal things ready and, you know, get crossing all the T's and dotting the I's and so on. But there it makes a bit more sense, I think, because of those massive oil discoveries. And those oil discoveries are going to be, they're going to have such an impact on the Namibian economy. Whereas even if South Africa had the same kind of magnitude of oil discoveries, it wouldn't be, wouldn't have as much, nearly as much of an impact on our economy as it's going to have on the Namibian economy. Because, I mean, I'm guessing it, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Namibian economy is smaller than most of our provinces' economies. It's maybe only bigger than, say, like the Northern Cape's economy or something. It's certainly smaller than the big three economies in South Africa, in Gauteng, Western Cape, and KwaZulu-Natal. So there it makes a bit more sense. And yeah, I think Namibia is also quite an interesting country to keep an eye on, especially with this kind of thing. And they've also got an election coming up later this year.
John, any final thoughts?
Yeah, just a comment. Like, one of the viewers suggested whether this could be an introduction to an increase in VAT. VAT. And yes, you know, you could do this. You could say, we want to have a sovereign wealth fund from 2026. And to kick it off, we're going to increase VAT by whatever, 2 percentage points. And this money must go into that sovereign wealth fund. But like any commentator in South Africa is going to say, okay, you're raising an additional whatever few hundred billions, well, tens of billions of rands. Like, why are you not spending that money on poverty alleviation? Or, you know, on increasing civil servant wages or on fixing the trains? Like, there's so much stuff to do in South Africa that we don't have this excess revenue where you'd use this extra money for something like that. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, also, you know, VAT is a tax that's applied on everyone because everyone pays VAT, right? When you buy things that aren't basic food items. And yeah. So, you know, you can see many, many poor South Africans being disproportionately hit by that. And, you know, rising effectively, it would be essentially a rise in inflation for a lot of people in terms of what they're actually spending. And with the ANC in such a dangerous political electoral position, this would only make things worse.
Yes. And I must quickly say something. It's a bit off track, but on the question of VAT. So we've got a proposal to drop VAT. we think taxes should be cut, and the most important tax that should be cut is VAT, because every single South African who buys anything is going to benefit from that. So it's like a huge stimulus to the economy, and we've got a way to do that without cutting state spending, without taking on more debt, without increasing taxes. You could actually do this. It's like 100 billion rand stimulus for the economy by cutting the VAT rate. So that would actually make much more sense than setting up a sovereign wealth fund.
No, definitely. Okay, let's move on to our next story. Now, we've got the latest quarterly crime statistics suggest that 6,200 people were murdered in South Africa between April and June. In absolute numbers, the largest percentage of these came from KZN. Gauteng also contributed the second largest number in absolute terms, with the Western Cape being in third place. Most of the gang killings in the country were, as per usual, in the Western Cape, with I think 230 out of the 270 gang-related murders were occurred in the Western Cape. Five police officers were killed on duty, and the overall rate of contact crimes increased by about 2%. So that's bad crime news. So let's look a little bit at one of the efforts that has been undertaken by the government in Gauteng to try and combat the massive crime problem. And this is the Panyaza Lesufi's Crime Prevention Warden Program, or the Ama Panyaza, as they're sometimes referred to. This is essentially a version of having a kind of provincial sort of police force. The Western Cape has already done something similar-ish with the LEAP program, but this program, this Crime Prevention Warden plan, was essentially the ANC's take on a kind of more decentralized police force. And let's just say that it's had some problems. I think it's a very good example of how you can very much, while localizing and decentralizing the police, I think is a good idea. In this case, this is kind of a textbook of how to do it wrong. So the Daily Maverick did a bit of an investigation into one aspect of this crime prevention program, which was the hiring of military vets and former sort of MK and PAC military vets from the struggle, who were supposed to be then retrained to be these crime prevention wardens, and they would take part in efforts to combat crime across Gauteng. But people interviewed by the Daily Maverick on this front have raised a lot of red flags about a whole bunch of aspects of this program. One veteran requesting anonymity for safety reasons, who has a background in crime prevention policy and was a crime prevention section leader in the military police from 1994 to 1996, said that he applied basically to the program, signed up for the thing, and then just simply didn't hear back from them, while at the same time he saw people who he knew from his township were being accepted into the program despite having absolutely no sort of military background. In one instance, veterans were called for a medical checkup. The meeting was allegedly held in Randburg. The veteran interviewed by the Maverick said, "When we arrived there, they gave us uniforms, the green ones. They gave us T-shirts and caps. It was just green, green, green. Everybody was in green. It was around election time, and you could see it was now election machinery." During the meeting, Lesufi allegedly instructed all the verified military veterans should visit their regional offices to sign up for training, irrespective of their formations or if they completed fingerprint capturing. The veteran went on to say, "In Benoni, we got transport to the regional office. We were asked for our tax clearance qualifications and certified IDs. Then we signed contracts. The contracts were signed before the medical checkups, and they told us not to put dates on them." There was one guy who was interviewed by the Daily Maverick who is described as being a military veteran who has substance abuse problems, as well as severe injuries to his knees and elbows, who was recruited into this program and was essentially, this was after the doctors looked at him and said, "Yeah, this guy can't run at all because he's too injured." And he said, quote, "When I was there, I informed them about my knee and elbow issues and requested they take these into consideration. They advised me to see a doctor who confirmed my injuries and recommended I be on light duty. The doctor wrote a letter saying I couldn't run but could participate in light drills." And yet was still sort of included in the crime prevention program. So I'm not quite sure how a severely injured man with substance abuse problems is going to be able to be an effective crime warden in the province. Palyazo Lesufi has been a very aggressive advocate of this program. He had a fight with Becky Kwele because apparently Becky Kwele did not want to issue firearms to these guys. The justice minister in 2023 gave the Amo Panyaza essentially police powers, which is quite generous of him. And there have definitely been instances where these guys have abused their power. In August of 2023, a number of these crime prevention wardens broke into someone's house who they suspected of committing some sort of crime and beat the man nearly to death. John, let me start again with you. This is just such a farce of a program, and it's very difficult for me to see the Lesufi's program here as anything other than basically a kind of Lesufi-aligned militia in Gauteng. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's hard to avoid that conclusion. Given some of the results we've seen now that you've read out, I think vindicate John Steenhuisen's comments, as unflattering as they might have been about these crime wardens being drunkards dragged from shebeens engaged on vigilante justice. Some of that certainly seems to be borne out here. So the program looks like it's lacking in professionalism. Lacking in training, lacking in focus, lacking in leadership. And then the question is, what is it for? And then it really does look like it is a political ploy. It is a way to get some voters on side by spending public money responsibly, effectively.
Yeah, Marius, one of the complaints about this program has also been that people who might have been qualified have not been accepted into the program because instead, those positions have essentially been sold to others. This is a common problem across many government departments where whoever's in charge of the hiring process will literally sell jobs. As you can imagine, this produces an enormous amount of anger amongst people looking desperate for opportunities. What do you make of this program, Maurice?
Well, look, I think that also indicates a deeper malaise in South Africa, that there's such a high unemployment rate. And sometimes you see these photos, they'll be like, for example, Etegwini will say they're hiring, they've got 100 positions for Metro Police. And then you see, you can kind of drop off your CV between 8 and 12 at the Civic Center. And then you see the queues of people who are there. I mean, there'll be thousands of people who've come to apply for 100 jobs or whatever the case is. And so obviously, you shouldn't be buying positions and so on, but, people get desperate and then they want to put food on the table and so on. So I think this is all, it's not just a case of two corrupt people doing something. It's a result of complex issues and a reflection on the economy of South Africa that people are willing to, buy positions and that there are people who are willing to sell positions as well. So, but yeah, it's... the Amo Panyazas aren't the best idea ever, but I think having devolved police forces or police services is a pretty good idea. I mean, where the Western Cape is kind of doing with the LEAP program, and we have this now. Exactly. But I mean, obviously, we want people to be a little bit more professional, and we don't want, if somebody's going to be doing this kind of thing, it can't be somebody who's addicted to Nyope and only has one leg or whatever the case is and sounds like some guys like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, decentralization, I think, does solve many problems in our police force. However, it is not the be-all and end-all. It is not the silver bullet. And I think the Panyaza plan here shows that you still need to hold the political leadership accountable so that they actually do these things properly. And I hope that any future coalition government in Gauteng, which I think at some point is inevitable, will either scrap or seriously reform this program so that it is more professional. But John, any final thoughts before we close up for today?
Yeah, maybe just the idea that for federalism and decentralization to work, you need competition on the demand side. So in other words, for this to work, you need like the LEAP program to compete with the crime wardens, and for businesses and taxpayers and residents to make decisions based on that and be able to say, okay, I don't want to live where like those crime wardens are because they come into my house and beat me up. I'd rather go to the Western Cape where, you know, they work properly. And to some extent, we're seeing that, you know, with the migration to the Western Cape. And that is how you get competing systems to be rewarded and punished depending on their performance, which is ultimately the idea behind functioning federalism or decentralization. So in a way, it's working a little bit, but it's a slow process and painful for those subjected to the worst governance, as I think indeed. All three of us are.
Well said. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.